The Forever War, Disc 2.
They stood a slab up on edge. It had two openings for the LSU input and exhaust, and proceeded to weld it to the bottom plank with a narrow laser beam. On Earth, we'd just use glue, but here the only fluid was helium, which has lots of interesting properties, but is definitely not sticky. After about 10 minutes, we were completely walled up. I could feel the LSU humming. I switched on my suit light, the first time since we landed on Darkseid, and the glare made purple blotches dance in front of my eyes. Mandela, this is Ho. Stay in your suit at least 2 or 3 minutes. We're putting hot air in, but it's coming back just this side of liquid. I watched the purple fade for a while. Okay, it's still cold, but you can make it. I popped my suit. It wouldn't open all the way, but I didn't have too much trouble getting out. The suit was still cold enough to take some skin off my fingers and butt as I wiggled out. I had to crawl feet first down the coffin to get to Singer. It got darker fast, moving away from my light. When I popped his suit, a rush of hot stink hit me in the face. In the dim light, his skin was dark red and splotchy. His breathing was very shallow, and I could see his heart palpitating. First I unhooked the relief tubes, an unpleasant business, then the biosensors, and then I had the problem of getting his arms out of their sleeves. It's pretty easy to do for yourself. You twist this way and turn that way, and the arm pops out. Doing it from the outside is a different matter. I had to twist his arm, and then reach under and move the suit's arm to match. It takes muscle to move a suit around from the outside. Once I had one arm out, it was pretty easy. I just crawled forward, putting my feet on the suit's shoulders, and pulled on his free arm. He slid out of the suit like an oyster slipping out of its shell. I popped the spare suit, and after a lot of pulling and pushing, managed to get his legs in. Hooked up the biosensors and the front relief tube. He'd have to do the other one himself. It's too complicated. For the nth time, I was glad not to have been born female. They have to have two of those damn plumber's friends, instead of just one and a simple hose. I left his arms out of the sleeves. The suit would be useless for any kind of work anyhow. Waldos have to be tailored to the individual. His eyelids fluttered. Mandela, where the fuck? I explained slowly, and he seemed to get most of it. Now, I'm going to close you up and go get into my suit. I'll have the crew cut the end off this thing, and I'll haul you out. Got it? He nodded. Strange to see that. When you nod or shrug inside a suit, it doesn't communicate anything. I crawled into my suit, hooked up the attachments, and chinned the general freak. Doc, I think he's going to be okay. Get us out of here now. Will do. Ho's voice. The LSU hum was replaced by a chatter, then a throb, evacuating the box to prevent an explosion. One corner of the seam grew red, then white, and a bright crimson beam lanced through, not a foot away from my head. I scrunched back as far as I could. The beam slid up the seam and around three corners back to where it started. The end of the box fell away slowly, trailing filaments of melted plast. Wait for the stuff to harden, Mandela. Sanchez, I'm not that stupid. Here you go. Somebody tossed a line to me. That would be smarter than dragging him out by myself. I threaded a long bite under his arms and tied it behind his neck. Then I scrambled out to help them pull, which was silly. They had a dozen people already lined up to haul. Singer got out all right and was actually sitting up while Doc Jones checked his readout. People were asking me about it and congratulating me when suddenly Ho said, "Look!" and pointed toward the horizon. It was a black ship coming in fast. I just had time to think it wasn't fair They weren't supposed to attack until the last few days. And then, the ship was right on top of us. Chapter 9. We all flopped to the ground instinctively, but the ship didn't attack. It blasted braking rockets and dropped to land on skids. Then it skied around to come to a rest beside the building site. Everybody had it figured out and was standing around sheepishly when the two suited figures stepped out of the ship. A familiar voice crackled over the general freak. "Every one of you saw us coming in, and not one of you responded with laser fire. It wouldn't have done any good, but it would have indicated a certain amount of fighting spirit. You have a week or less before the real thing, and since the sergeant and I will be here, I will insist that you show a little more will to live. Acting Sergeant Potter?"
"Here, sir."
"Give me a detail of 12 people to unload cargo. We brought 100 small robot drones for target practice, so that you might have at least a fighting chance when a live target comes over. Move, now. We only have 30 minutes before the ship returns to Miami."
I checked, and it was actually more like 40 minutes.
Having the captain and sergeant there didn't really make much difference. We were still on our own. They were just observing. Once we got the floor down, it took only one day to complete the bunker. It was a gray oblong, featureless, except for the airlock blister and four windows. On top was a swivel-mounted gigawatt laser. The operator, you couldn't call him a gunner, sat in a chair holding dead man switches in both hands. The laser wouldn't fire as long as he was holding one of those switches. If he let go, it would automatically aim for any moving aerial object and fire at will. Primary detection and aiming was by means of a kilometer-high antenna mounted beside the bunker. It was the only arrangement that could really be expected to work, with the horizon so close and human reflexes so slow. You couldn't have the thing fully automatic, because in theory, friendly ships might also approach. The aiming computer could choose among up to 12 targets appearing simultaneously, firing at the largest ones first, and it would get all 12 in the space of half a second. The installation was partly protected from enemy fire by an efficient ablative layer that covered everything except the human operator. But then, they were dead man switches. One man above guarding 80 inside. The Army's good at that kind of arithmetic. Once the bunker was finished, half of us stayed inside at all times, feeling very much like targets, taking turns operating the laser while the other half went on maneuvers. About 4 clicks from the base was a large lake of frozen hydrogen. One of our most important maneuvers was to learn how to get around on the treacherous stuff. It wasn't too difficult. You couldn't stand up on it, so you had to belly down and sled. If you had somebody to push you from the edge, getting started was no problem. Otherwise, you had to scrabble with your hands and feet, pushing down as hard as was practical until you started moving, in a series of little jumps. Once started, you'd keep going until you ran out of ice. You could steer a little bit by digging in, hand and foot on the appropriate side, but you couldn't slow to a stop that way. So it was a good idea not to go too fast and wind up positioned in such a way that your helmet didn't absorb the shock of stopping. We went through all the things we'd done on the Miami side: weapons practice, demolition, attack patterns. We also launched drones at irregular intervals toward the bunker. Thus, 10 or 15 times a day, the operators got to demonstrate their skill in letting go of the handles as soon as the proximity light went on. I had 4 hours of that, like everybody else. I was nervous until the first attack, when I saw how little there was to it. The light went on, I let go, the gun aimed, and when the drone peeped over the horizon, zzz!
Nice touch of color, the molten metal spraying through space. Otherwise, not too exciting. So none of us were worried about the upcoming graduation exercise, thinking it would be just more of the same. Miami base attacked on the 13th day, with two simultaneous missiles streaking over opposite sides of the horizon at some 40 kilometers per second. The laser vaporized the first one with no trouble, but the second got within 8 clicks of the bunker before it was hit. We were coming back from maneuvers, about a click away from the bunker. I wouldn't have seen it happen if I hadn't been looking directly at the bunker the moment of the attack. The second missile sent a shower of molten debris straight toward the bunker. 11 pieces hit, and as we later reconstructed it, this is what happened. The first casualty was Majima, so well-loved Majima, inside the bunker, who was hit in the back and the head and died instantly. With the drop in pressure, the LSU went into high gear. Friedman was standing in front of the main airco outlet and was blown into the opposite wall, hard enough to knock him unconscious. He died of decompression before the others could get him to his suit. Everybody else managed to stagger through the gale and get into their suits, but Garcia's suit had been holed and didn't do him any good. By the time we got there, they had turned off the LSU and were welding up the holes in the wall. One man was trying to scrape up the unrecognizable mess that had been Majima. I could hear him sobbing and retching. They had already taken Garcia and Friedman outside for burial. The captain took over the repair detail from Potter. Sergeant Cortez led the sobbing man over to a corner and came back to work on cleaning up Majima's remains, alone. He didn't order anybody to help, and nobody volunteered. Chapter 10. As a graduation exercise, we were unceremoniously stuffed into a ship, Earth's Hope, the same one we rode to Charon, and bundled off to Stargate at a little more than 1G. The trip seemed endless, about 6 months subjective time, and boring, but not as hard on the carcass as going to Charon had been. Captain Stott made us review our training orally, day by day, and we did exercises every day until we were worn to a collective frazzle. Stargate 1 was like Charon's dark side, only more so. The base on Stargate 1 was smaller than Miami base, only a little bigger than the one we constructed on Darkside, and we were due to lay over a week to help expand the facilities. The crew there was very glad to see us, especially the two females, who looked a little worn around the edges. We all crowded into the small dining hall, where Sub-Major Williamson, the man in charge of Stargate 1, gave us some disconcerting news.
"Everybody get comfortable. Get off the tables, though. There's plenty of floor. I have some idea of what you just went through, training on Charon. I won't say it's all been wasted, but where you're headed, things will be quite different. Warmer."
He paused to let that soak in.
Aleph Origi, the first collapsar ever detected, revolves around the normal star Epsilon Origi in a 27-year orbit. The enemy has a base of operations not on a regular portal planet of Aleph, but on a planet in orbit around Epsilon. We don't know much about the planet, just that it goes around Epsilon once every 745 days, is about 3/4 the size of Earth, and has an albedo of 0.8, meaning it's probably covered with clouds. We can't say precisely how hot it will be, but judging from its distance from Epsilon, it's probably rather hotter than Earth. Of course, we don't know whether you'll be working, fighting on light side or dark side, equator or poles. It's highly unlikely that the atmosphere will be breathable. At any rate, you'll stay inside your suits. Now, You know exactly as much about where you're going as I do. Questions? Sir? Stein drawled. Now we know where we're going. Anybody know what we're going to do when we get there?
Williamson shrugged. That's up to your captain, and your sergeant, and the captain of Earth's Hope, and Hope's logistic computer. We just don't have enough data yet to project a course of action for you. It may be a long and bloody battle. It may be just a case of walking in to pick up the pieces. Conceivably, the Taurans might want to make a peace offer. Cortez snorted. In which case, you would simply be part of our muscle, our bargaining power. He looked at Cortez mildly. No one can say for sure. The orgy that night was amusing, but it was like trying to sleep in the middle of a raucous beach party. The only area big enough to sleep all of us was the dining hall. They draped a few bedsheets here and there for privacy, then unleashed Stargate's 18 sex-starved men on our women. Compliant and promiscuous by military custom and law, but desiring nothing so much as sleep on solid ground. The 18 men acted as if they were compelled to try as many permutations as possible, and their performance was impressive, in a strictly quantitative sense, that is. Those of us who were keeping count led a cheering section for some of the more gifted members. I think that's the right word. The next morning, and every other morning we were on Stargate 1, we staggered out of bed and into our suits to go outside and work on the new wing. Eventually, Stargate would be tactical and logistical headquarters for the war, with thousands of permanent personnel guarded by a half-dozen heavy cruisers in Hope's class. When we started, it was 2 shacks and 20 people. When we left, it was 4 shacks and 20 people. The work was hardly work at all compared to Darkside, since we had plenty of light and got 16 hours inside for every 8 hours' work, and no drone attack for a final exam. When we shuttled back up to the Hope, nobody was too happy about leaving, though some of the more popular females declared it'd be good to get some rest. Stargate was the last easy, safe assignment we'd have before taking up arms against the Taurans. And as Williamson had pointed out the first day, there was no way of predicting what that would be like. Most of us didn't feel too enthusiastic about making a Collapsar jump either. We'd been assured that we wouldn't even feel it happen, just free fall all the way. I wasn't convinced. As a physics student, I'd had the usual courses in general relativity and theories of gravitation. We only had a little direct data at that time. Stargate was discovered when I was in grade school. But the mathematical model seemed clear enough. The Collapsar Stargate was a perfect sphere, about 3 kilometers in radius. It was suspended forever in a state of gravitational collapse that should have meant its surface was dropping toward its center at nearly the speed of light. Relativity propped it up, at least gave it the illusion of being there. The way all reality becomes illusory and observer-oriented when you study general relativity. Or Buddhism. Or get drafted. At any rate, there would be a theoretical point in space-time when one end of our ship was just above the surface of the Collapsar, and the other end was 1 kilometer away in our frame of reference. In any sane universe, this would set up tidal stresses and tear the ship apart, and we would be just another 1,000,000 kilograms of degenerate matter on the theoretical surface, rushing headlong to nowhere for the rest of eternity, or dropping to the center in the next 1,000,000,000th of a second. You pays your money, and you takes your frame of reference. But they were right. We blasted away from Stargate 1, made a few course corrections, and then just dropped for about 1 hour. Then a bell rang, and we sank into our cushions under a steady 2 gravities of deceleration. We were in enemy territory. Chapter 11. We'd been decelerating at 2 gravities for almost 9 days when the battle began. Lying on our couches being miserable, all we felt were 2 soft bumps, missiles being released. Some 8 hours later, the squawk box crackled.
"Attention all crew, this is the captain."
Kinsana, the pilot, was only a lieutenant, but was allowed to call himself captain aboard the vessel, where he outranked all of us, even Captain Stott.
"You grunts in the cargo hold can listen, too. We just engaged the enemy with 2 50-gigaton tachyon missiles and have destroyed both the enemy vessel and another object which it had launched approximately 3 microseconds before. The enemy has been trying to overtake us for the past 179 hours, ship time. At the time of the engagement, the enemy was moving at a little over half the speed of light relative to Aleph, and was only about 30 AUs from Earth's Hope. It was moving at 0.47C relative to us, and thus we would have been coincident in space-time. Rammed in a little more than 9 hours. The missiles were launched at 0719 ship's time and destroyed the enemy at 1540, both tachyon bombs detonating within 1,000 clicks of the enemy objects. The 2 missiles were a type whose propulsion system was itself only a barely controlled tachyon bomb. They accelerated at a constant rate of 100 Gs and were traveling at a relativistic speed by the time the nearby mass of the enemy ship detonated them. "We expect no further interference from enemy vessels. Our velocity with respect to Aleph will be 0 in another 5 hours. We will then begin the journey back. The return will take 27 days.
General moans and dejected cussing. Everybody knew all that already, of course, but we didn't care to be reminded of it. So, after another month of logy calisthenics and drill, at a constant 2 gravities, we got our first look at the planet we were going to attack. Invaders from outer space. Yes, sir. It was a blinding white crescent waiting for us, 2 AUs out from Epsilon. The captain had pinned down the location of the enemy base from 50 AUs out, and we had jockeyed in on a wide arc, keeping the bulk of the planet between them and us. That didn't mean we were sneaking up on them. Quite the contrary. They launched 3 abortive attacks, but it put us in a stronger defensive position. Until we had to go to the surface, that is. Then only the ship and its Starfleet crew would be reasonably safe. Since the planet rotated rather slowly, once every 10 1/2 days, a stationary orbit for the ship had to be 150,000 clicks out. This made the people in the ship feel quite secure, with 6,000 miles of rock and 90,000 miles of space between them and the enemy. But it meant a whole second's time lag in communication between us on the ground and the ship's battle computer. A person could get awful dead while that neutrino pulse crawled up and back. Our vague orders were to attack the base and gain control while damaging a minimum of enemy equipment. We were to take at least 1 enemy alive. We were under no circumstances to allow ourselves to be taken alive, however. And the decision wasn't up to us. 1 special pulse from the battle computer, and that speck of plutonium in your power plant would fizz with all of 0.01% efficiency, and you'd be nothing but a rapidly expanding, very hot plasma. They strapped us into 6 scout ships, 1 platoon of 12 people in each, and we blasted away from Earth's Hope at 8 Gs. Each scout ship was supposed to follow its own carefully random path to our rendezvous point, 108 clicks from the base. 14 drone ships were launched at the same time to confound the enemy's anti-spacecraft system. The landing went off almost perfectly. 1 ship suffered minor damage, a near miss boiling away some of the ablative material on 1 side of the hull, but it'd still be able to make it and return, keeping its speed down while in the atmosphere. We zigged and zagged and wound up first ship at the rendezvous point. There was only one trouble. It was under 4 kilometers of water. I could almost hear that machine, 90,000 miles away, grinding its mental gears, adding this new bit of data. We proceeded just as if we were landing on solid ground, braking rockets, falling, skids out, hit the water, skip, hit the water, skip, hit the water, sink. It would have made sense to go ahead and land on the bottom. We were streamlined, after all, and water just another fluid. But the hull wasn't strong enough to hold up a 4-kilometer column of water. Sergeant Cortez was in the scout ship with us. "Sarge, tell that computer to do something. We're going to get..." "Oh, shut up, Mandela. Trust to the Lord." Lord was definitely lowercase when Cortez said it. There was a loud, bubbly sigh, then another, and a slight increase in pressure on my back that meant the ship was rising. "Flotation bags?" Cortez didn't deign to answer, or didn't know. That was it. We rose to within 10 or 15 meters of the surface and stopped, suspended there. Through the port, I could see the surface above, shimmering like a mirror of hammered silver. I wondered what it would be like to be a fish and have a definite roof over your world. I watched another ship splash in. It made a great cloud of bubbles and turbulence, then fell, slightly tail first, for a short distance before large bags popped out under each delta wing. Then it bobbed up to about our level and stayed.
"This is Captain Stott. Now listen carefully. There is a beach, some 28 clicks from your present position, in the direction of the enemy. You will be proceeding to this beach by scout ship, and from there will mount your assault on the Torin position."
That was some improvement. We'd only have to walk 80 clicks. We deflated the bags, blasted to the surface, and flew in a slow, spread-out formation to the beach. It took several minutes. As the ship scraped to a halt, I could hear pumps humming, making the cabin pressure equal to the air pressure outside. Before it had quite stopped moving, the escape slot beside my couch slid open. I rolled out onto the wing of the craft and jumped to the ground. 10 seconds to find cover. I sprinted across loose gravel to the tree line, a twisty bramble of tall, sparse, bluish-green shrubs. I dove into the briar patch and turned to watch the ships leave. The drones that were left rose slowly to about 100 meters, then took off in all directions with a bone-jarring roar. The real scout ships slid slowly back into the water. Maybe that was a good idea. It wasn't a terribly attractive world, but certainly would be easier to get around in than the cryogenic nightmare we were trained for. The sky was a uniform, dull silver brightness that merged with the mist over the ocean so completely it was impossible to tell where the water ended and air began. Small wavelets licked at the black gravel shore, much too slow and graceful in the 3/4 Earth normal gravity. Even from 50 meters away, the rattle of billions of pebbles rolling with the tide was loud in my ears. The air temperature was 79 degrees centigrade, not quite hot enough for the sea to boil, even though the air pressure was low compared to Earth's. Wisps of steam drifted quickly upward from the line where water met land. I wondered how a lone man would survive exposed here, without a suit. Would the heat or the low oxygen, partial pressure 1/8 Earth normal, kill him first? Or was there some deadly microorganism that would beat them both?
"This is Cortez. Everybody come over and assemble on me."
He was standing on the beach a little to the left of me, waving his hand in a circle over his head. I walked toward him through the shrubs. They were brittle, unsubstantial, seemed paradoxically dried out in the steamy air. They wouldn't offer much in the way of cover.
"We'll be advancing on a heading 0.05 radians east of north.
I want Platoon 1 to take point. 2 and 3 follow about 20 meters behind to the left and right. 7, Command Platoon, is in the middle, 20 meters behind 2 and 3. 5 and 6 bring up the rear in a semicircular closed flank. Everybody straight?
Sure, we could do that arrowhead maneuver in our sleep.
Okay, let's move out.
I was in Platoon 7, the command group. Captain Stott put me there not because I was expected to give any commands, but because of my training in physics. The command group was supposedly the safest place, buffered by 6 platoons. People were assigned to it because there was some tactical reason for them to survive at least a little longer than the rest. Cortez was there to give orders. Chavez was there to correct suit malfunctions. The senior medic, Doc Wilson, the only medic who actually had an MD, was there, and so was Theodopoulos, the radio engineer, our link with the captain, who had elected to stay in orbit. The rest of us were assigned to the command group by dint of special training or aptitude that wouldn't normally be considered of a tactical nature. Facing a totally unknown enemy, there was no way of telling what might prove important. Thus, I was there because I was the closest the company had to a physicist. Rogers was biology, Tate was chemistry. Ho could crank out a perfect score on the Rhine extrasensory perception test every time. Bohrs was a polyglot, able to speak 21 languages fluently, idiomatically. Petrov's talent was that he had tested out to have not one molecule of xenophobia in his psyche. Keating was a skilled acrobat. Debbie Hollister, Lucky Hollister, showed a remarkable aptitude for making money, and also had a consistently high Rhine potential.
Chapter 12. When we first set out, we were using the jungle camouflage combination on our suits, but what passed for jungle in these anemic tropics was too sparse. We looked like a band of conspicuous harlequins trooping through the woods. Cortez had us switch to black, but that was just as bad, as the light of Epsilon came evenly from all parts of the sky, and there were no shadows except ours. We finally settled on the dun-colored desert camouflage. The nature of the countryside changed slowly as we walked north away from the sea. The thorn stalks, I guess you could call them trees, came in fewer numbers, but were bigger around and less brittle. At the base of each was a tangled mass of vine with the same blue-green color, which spread out in a flattened cone some 10 meters in diameter. There was a delicate green flower the size of a man's head near the top of each tree. Grass began to grow some 5 clicks from the sea. It seemed to respect the tree's property rights, leaving a strip of bare earth around each cone of vine. At the edge of such a clearing, it would grow as timid blue-green stubble. Then, moving away from the tree, would get thicker and taller until it reached shoulder high in some places, where the separation between two trees was unusually large. The grass was a lighter, greener shade than the trees and vines. We changed the color of our suits to the bright green we had used for maximum visibility on Charon. Keeping to the thickest part of the grass, we were fairly inconspicuous. We covered over 20 clicks each day, buoyant after months under 2 Gs, until the second day the only form of animal life we saw was a kind of black worm, finger-sized, with hundreds of psyllium legs, like the bristles of a brush. Rogers said that there obviously had to be some larger creature around, or there would be no reason for the trees to have thorns. So we were doubly on guard, expecting trouble both from the Torrens and the unidentified large creature. Potter's 2nd platoon was on point. The general freak was reserved for her, since her platoon would likely be the first to spot any trouble. "Sarge, this is Potter," we all heard. "Movement ahead."
"Get down, then."
"We are. Don't think they see us."
"First platoon, go up to the right of point. Keep down. Fourth, get up to the left. Tell me when you get in position. Sixth platoon, stay back and guard the rear. Fifth and third, close with the command group."
24 people whispered out of the grass to join us. Cortez must have heard from the fourth platoon.
"Good. How about you, first?"
"Okay, fine. How many are there?"
8, we can see.
Potter's voice.
"Good. When I give the word, open fire. Shoot to kill."
"Sarge, they're just animals."
"Potter, if you've known all this time what a tauren looks like, you should have told us. Shoot to kill."
"But we need..."
"We need a prisoner, but we don't need to escort him 40 clicks to his home base and keep an eye on him while we fight. Clear?"
"Yes, Sergeant."
"Okay. 7th, all you brains and weirds, we're going up and watch. 5th and 3rd, come along to guard."
We crawled through the meter-high grass to where the 2nd platoon had stretched out in a firing line.
"I don't see anything,"
Cortez said.
"Ahead, and just to the left. Dark green." They were only a shade darker than the grass, but after you saw the first one, you could see them all, moving slowly around some 30 meters ahead.
"Fire!"
Cortez fired first, then 12 streaks of crimson leaped out, and the grass wilted black, disappeared, and the creatures convulsed and died, trying to scatter.
"Hold fire, hold it!"
Cortez stood up.
"We want to have something left. 2nd platoon, follow me."
He strode out toward the smoldering corpses, laser finger pointed out front, obscene divining rod pulling him toward the carnage. I felt my gorge rising, and knew that all the lurid training tapes, all the horrible deaths and training accidents, hadn't prepared me for this sudden reality, that I had a magic wand that I could point at a life and make it a smoking piece of half-raw meat. I wasn't a soldier, nor ever wanted to be one, nor ever would want.
"Okay, 7th, come on up."
While we were walking toward them, one of the creatures moved, a tiny shudder, and Cortez flicked the beam of his laser over it with an almost negligent gesture. It made a hand-deep gash across the creature's middle. It died like the others, without emitting a sound. They were not quite as tall as humans, but wider in girth. They were covered with dark green, almost black fur, white curls where the laser had singed. They appeared to have 3 legs and an arm. The only ornament to their shaggy heads was a mouth, wet black orifice filled with flat black teeth. They were thoroughly repulsive, but their worst feature was not a difference from human beings, but a similarity. Whenever the laser had opened a body cavity, milk-white, glistening, veined globes and coils of organs spilled out, and their blood was dark, clotting red.
"Rogers, take a look. Torrens or not?"
Rogers knelt by one of the disemboweled creatures and opened a flat plastic box filled with glittering dissecting tools. She selected a scalpel.
"One way we might be able to find out."
Doc Wilson watched over her shoulder as she methodically slit the membrane covering several organs.
"Here."
She held up a blackish, fibrous mass between 2 fingers, a parody of daintiness through all that armor.
"So?"
"It's grass, Sergeant. If the Torrens eat the grass and breathe the air, they certainly found a planet remarkably like their home."
She tossed it away.
"They're animals, Sergeant. Just fucking animals."
"I don't know," Doc Wilson said. "Just because they walk around on all 4s, 3s maybe, and eat grass,
Well, let's check out the brain. She found one that had been hit in the head and scraped the superficial black char from the wound. Look at that. It was almost solid bone. She tugged and ruffled the hair all over the head of another one. What the hell does it use for sensory organs? No eyes or ears or... She stood up. Nothing on that fucking head but a mouth and 10 centimeters of skull. To protect nothing, not a fucking thing.
If I could shrug, I'd shrug, the doctor said. It doesn't prove anything. A brain doesn't have to look like a mushy walnut, and it doesn't have to be in the head. Maybe that skull isn't bone. Maybe that's the brain, some crystal lattice.
Yeah, but the fucking stomach's in the right place, and if those aren't intestines, I'll eat...
Look, Cortez said, this is real interesting, but all we need to know is whether that thing's dangerous. Then we've got to move on. We don't have all...
They aren't dangerous, Rogers began. They don't...
Medic! Doc!
Somebody back at the firing line was waving his arms. Doc sprinted back to him, the rest of us following.
What's wrong?
He had reached back and unclipped his medical kit on the run.
It's Ho! She's out!
Doc swung open the door on Ho's biomedical monitor. He didn't have to look far.
She's dead.
Dead? Cortez said. What the hell?
Just a minute.
Doc plugged a jack into the monitor and fiddled with some dials on his kit.
Everybody's biomed readout is stored for 12 hours. I'm running it backwards. Should be able to...
There.
What?
4.5 minutes ago. Must have been when you opened fire.
Jesus.
Well?
Massive cerebral hemorrhage.
No. He watched the dials.
No warning, no indication of anything out of the ordinary. Blood pressure up, pulse up, but normal under the circumstances. Nothing to indicate.
He reached down and popped her suit. Her fine oriental features were distorted in a horrible grimace, both gums showing. Sticky fluid ran from under her collapsed eyelids, and a trickle of blood still dripped from each ear. Doc Wilson closed the suit back up.
I've never seen anything like it. It's as if a bomb went off in her skull.
Oh, fuck, Rogers said. She was Ryan-sensitive, wasn't she?
That's right.
Cortez sounded thoughtful.
All right, everybody listen up. Platoon leaders, check your platoons and see if anybody's missing or hurt. Anybody else in 7th?
I've got a splitting headache, Sarge,
Lucky said. 4 others had bad headaches. One of them affirmed that he was slightly Ryan-sensitive. The others didn't know.
Cortez, I think it's obvious, Doc Wilson said, that we should give these monsters wide berth, especially shouldn't harm any more of them. Not with 5 people susceptible to whatever apparently killed Ho.
Of course, goddammit. I don't need anybody to tell me that. We'd better get moving. I just filled the captain in on what happened. He agrees that we'd better get as far away from here as we can before we stop for the night.
Let's get back in formation and continue on the same bearing. 5th platoon, take over point. 2nd, come back to the rear. Everybody else, same as before.
What about Ho? Lucky asked.
She'll be taken care of from the ship.
After we'd gone half a click, there was a flash and rolling thunder. Where Ho had been came a wispy, luminous mushroom cloud, boiling up to disappear against the gray sky.
Chapter 13. We stopped for the night. Actually, the sun wouldn't set for another 70 hours.
atop a slight rise some 10 clicks from where we had killed the aliens. But they weren't aliens, I had to remind myself. We were. 2 platoons deployed in a ring around the rest of us, and we flopped down exhausted. Everybody was allowed 4 hours sleep and had 2 hours guard duty. Potter came over and sat next to me. I chinned her frequency. Hi, Mary Gay. Oh, William. Her voice over the radio was hoarse and cracking. God, it's so horrible. It's over now. I killed one of them, the first instant. I shot it right in the... I put my hand on her knee. The contact had a plastic click, and I jerked it back, visions of machines embracing, copulating. Don't feel singled out, Mary Gay. Whatever guilt there is... belongs evenly to all of us, but a triple portion for Cor... You privates quit jawing and get some sleep. You both pull guard in 2 hours. Okay, Sarge. Her voice was so sad and tired I couldn't bear it. I felt if I could only touch her, I could drain off the sadness like ground wire draining current. But we were each trapped in our own plastic world. Good night, William. Night. It's almost impossible to get sexually excited inside a suit, with the relief tube and all the silver chloride sensors poking you. But somehow this was my body's response to the emotional impotence. Maybe remembering more pleasant sleeps with Mary Gay, maybe feeling that in the midst of all this death, personal death could be very soon cranking up the procreative Derek for one last try. Lovely thoughts like this. I fell asleep and dreamed that I was a machine, mimicking the functions of life, creaking and clanking my clumsy way through a world, people too polite to say anything but giggling behind my back, and the little man who sat inside my head, pulling the levers and clutches and watching the dials. He was hopelessly mad and was storing up hurts for the day. Mandela, wake up, goddammit, your shift. I shuffled over to my place on the perimeter to watch for God knows what. But I was so weary I couldn't keep my eyes open. Finally, I tongued a stim tab, knowing I'd pay for it later. For over an hour I sat there, scanning my sector, left, right, near, far, the scene never changing, not even a breath of wind to stir the grass. Then suddenly the grass parted, and one of the three-legged creatures was right in front of me. I raised my finger, but didn't squeeze. Movement! Movement! Jesus Christ! There's one right... Hold your fire, for shit's sake! Don't shoot! Movement! Movement! I looked left and right, and as far as I could see, every perimeter guard had one of the blind, dumb creatures standing right in front of him. Maybe the drug I'd taken to stay awake made me more sensitive to whatever they did. My scalp crawled, and I felt a formless thing in my mind. The feeling you get when somebody has said something and you didn't quite hear it, want to respond, but the opportunity to ask him to repeat it is gone. The creature sat back on its haunches, leaning forward on the one front leg. Big green bear with a withered arm. Its power threaded through my mind, spiderwebs, echo of night terrors, trying to communicate, trying to destroy me. I couldn't know. All right, everybody on the perimeter, fall back. Slow. Don't make any quick gestures. Anybody got a headache or anything? Sergeant, this is Hollister. Lucky. They're trying to say something. I can almost... No, just... All I can get is that they think we're, well, funny. They're not afraid. You mean the one in front of you isn't... No, the feeling comes from all of them. They're all thinking the same thing.
Don't ask me how I know, I just do. Maybe they thought it was funny what they did to Ho. Maybe. I don't feel they're dangerous, just curious about us.
Sergeant, this is Bors.
Yeah?
The Torrens been here at least a year. Maybe they've learned how to communicate with these overgrown teddy bears. They might be spying on us, might be sending back...
I don't think they'd show themselves if that were the case,
Lucky said.
They can obviously hide from us pretty well when they want to.
Anyhow, Cortez said, if they're spies, the damage has been done. Don't think it'd be smart to take any action against them. I know you'd all like to see them dead for what they did to Ho. So would I. But we'd better be careful.
I didn't want to see them dead, but I'd just as soon not have seen them in any condition. I was walking backwards, slowly, toward the middle of camp. The creature didn't seem disposed to follow. Maybe he just knew we were surrounded. He was pulling up grass with his arm and munching.
Okay, all of you platoon leaders, wake everybody up, get a roll count. Let me know if anybody's been hurt. Tell your people we're moving out in 1 minute.
I don't know what Cortez had expected, but of course the creatures followed right along. They didn't keep us surrounded, just had 20 or 30 following us all the time. Not the same ones, either. Individuals would saunter away, and new ones would join the parade. It was pretty obvious that they weren't going to tire out. We were each allowed one stim tab. Without it, no one could have marched an hour. A second pill would have been welcome after the edge started to wear off, but the mathematics of the situation forbade it. We were still 30 clicks from the enemy base, 15 hours marching at the least. And though you could stay awake and energetic for 100 hours on the tabs, aberrations of judgment and perception snowballed after the second one, until, in extremis, the most bizarre hallucinations would be taken at face value, and a person could fidget for hours deciding whether to have breakfast. Under artificial stimulation, the company traveled with great energy for the first 6 hours, was slowing by the seventh, and ground to an exhausted halt after 9 hours and 19 kilometers. The teddy bears had never lost sight of us, and according to Lucky, had never stopped broadcasting. Cortez's decision was that we would stop for 7 hours, each platoon taking 1 hour of perimeter guard. I was never so glad to have been in the 7th platoon, as we stood guard the last shift, and thus were able to get 6 hours of uninterrupted sleep. In the few moments I lay awake after finally lying down, the thought came to me that the next time I closed my eyes could well be the last, and partly because of the drug hangover, mostly because of the past day's horrors, I found that I really didn't give a shit.
Chapter 14. Our first contact with the Torrens came during my shift. The teddy bears were still there when I woke up and replaced Doc Jones on guard. They'd gone back to their original formation, one in front of each guard position. The one who was waiting for me seemed a little larger than normal, but otherwise looked just like all the others. All the grass had been cropped where he was sitting, so he occasionally made forays to the left or right. But he always returned to sit right in front of me. You would say staring, if he had had anything to stare with. We had been facing each other for about 15 minutes when Cortez's voice rumbled,
"All right, everybody, wake up and get hid."
I followed instinct and flopped to the ground and rolled into a tall stand of grass.
"Enemy vessel overhead."
His voice was almost laconic. Strictly speaking, it wasn't really overhead, but rather passing somewhere east of us. It was moving slowly, maybe 100 clicks per hour, and looked like a broomstick surrounded by a dirty soap bubble. The creature riding it was a little more human-looking than the teddy bears, but still no prize.
I cranked my image amplifier up to 40 log, too, for a closer look. He had two arms and two legs, but his waist was so small you could encompass it with both hands. Under the tiny waist was a large horseshoe-shaped pelvic structure nearly a meter wide, from which dangled two long, skinny legs with no apparent knee joint. Above that waist, his body swelled out again to a chest no smaller than the huge pelvis. His arms looked surprisingly human, except that they were too long and under-muscled. There were too many fingers on his hands. Shoulderless, neckless. His head was a nightmarish growth that swelled like a goiter from his massive chest. Two eyes that looked like clusters of fish eggs, a bundle of tassels instead of a nose, and a rigidly open hole that might have been a mouth sitting low down where his Adam's apple should have been. Evidently, the soap bubble contained an amenable environment, as he was wearing absolutely nothing except his ridged hide that looked like skin submerged too long in hot water, then dyed a pale orange. He had no external genitalia, but nothing that might hint of mammary glands. So we opted for the male pronoun by default. Obviously, he either didn't see us or thought we were part of the herd of teddy bears. He never looked back at us, but just continued in the same direction we were headed, 0.05 rad east of north. Might as well go back to sleep now, if you can sleep after looking at that thing. We move out at 0435. 40 minutes. Because of the planet's opaque cloud cover, there had been no way to tell, from space, what the enemy base looked like or how big it was. We only knew its position, the same way we knew the position the scout ships were supposed to land on. So it, too, could easily have been underwater, or underground. But some of the drones were reconnaissance ships as well as decoys, and in their mock attacks on the base, one managed to get close enough to take a picture. Captain Stott beamed down a diagram of the place to Cortez, the only one with a visor in his suit, when we were 5 clicks from the base's radio position. We stopped, and he called all the platoon leaders in with the 7th platoon to confer. 2 teddy bears loped in, too. We tried to ignore them. Okay. The captain sent down some pictures of our objective. I'm going to draw a map. You platoon leaders copy. They took pads and styli out of their leg pockets while Cortez unrolled a large plastic mat. He gave it a shake to randomize any residual charge and turned on his stylus. Now, we're coming from this direction. He put an arrow at the bottom of the sheet. First thing we'll hit is this row of huts, probably billets or bunkers, but who the hell knows? Our initial objective is to destroy these buildings. The whole base is on a flat plain. There's no way we could really sneak by them. Potter here. Why can't we jump over them? Yeah, we could do that, and wind up completely surrounded, cut to ribbons. We take the buildings. After we do that, all I can say is that we'll have to think on our feet. From the aerial reconnaissance, we can figure out the function of only a couple of buildings, and that stinks. We might wind up wasting a lot of time demolishing the equivalent of an enlisted men's bar, ignoring a huge logistic computer because it looks like a garbage dump or something. Mandela here, I said. Isn't there a spaceport of some kind? Seems to me we ought to... I'll get to that, damn it. There's a ring of these huts all around the camp, so we've got to break through somewhere. This place'll be closest, less chance of giving away our position before we attack. There's nothing in the whole place that actually looks like a weapon. That doesn't mean anything, though. You could hide a gigawatt laser in each of those huts. Now, about 500 meters from the huts in the middle of the base, we'll come to this big flower-shaped structure. Cortez drew a large symmetrical shape that looked like the outline of a flower with seven petals.
What the hell this is, your guess is as good as mine. There's only one of them, though, so we don't damage it any more than we have to, which means we blast it to splinters if I think it's dangerous. Now, as far as your spaceport, Mandela, is concerned, there just isn't one. Nothing. That cruiser the Hope caulked had probably been left in orbit, like ours has to be. If they have any equivalent of a scout ship or drone missiles, they're either not kept here or they're well hidden.
Bohr's here. Then what did they attack with while we were coming down from orbit?
I wish we knew, Private. Obviously, we don't have any way of estimating their numbers, not directly. Recon pictures failed to show a single Tauran on the grounds of the base, meaning nothing, because it is an alien environment. Indirectly, though, we count the number of broomsticks, those flying things. There are 51 huts, and each has at most one broomstick. Four don't have any parked outside, but we located three at various other parts of the base. Maybe this indicates that there are 51 Taurans, one of whom was outside the base when the picture was taken.
Keating here, or 51 officers.
That's right. Maybe 50,000 infantrymen stacked in one of these buildings. No way to tell. Maybe 10 Taurans, each with 5 broomsticks, to use according to his mood. We've got one thing in our favor, and that's communications. They evidently use a frequency modulation of megahertz electromagnetic radiation.
Radio?
That's right, whoever you are. Identify yourself when you speak. So it's quite possible that they can't detect our phased neutrino communications. Also, just prior to the attack, the Hope is going to deliver a nice, dirty fission bomb. Detonate it in the upper atmosphere right over the base. That'll restrict them to line-of-sight communications for some time. Even those will be full of static.
Tate, here, why don't they just drop the bomb right in their lap, save us a lot of...
That doesn't even deserve an answer, Private. But the answer is they might, and you better hope they don't. If they caulk the base, it'll be for the safety of the Hope, after we've attacked, and probably before we're far enough away for it to make much difference. We keep that from happening by doing a good job. We have to reduce the base to where it can no longer function. At the same time, leave as much intact as possible. And take one prisoner.
Potter here, you mean at least one prisoner?
I mean what I say. One only.
Potter, you're relieved of your platoon. Send Chavez up.
All right, Sergeant.
The relief in her voice was unmistakable. Cortez continued with his map and instructions. There was one other building whose function was pretty obvious. It had a large steerable dish antenna on top. We were to destroy it as soon as the Grenadiers got in range. The attack plan was very loose. Our signal to begin would be the flash of the fission bomb. At the same time, several drones would converge on the base, so we could see what their anti-spacecraft defenses were. We would try to reduce the effectiveness of those defenses without destroying them completely. Immediately after the bomb and the drones, the Grenadiers would vaporize a line of 7 huts. Everybody would break through the hole into the base, and what would happen after that was anybody's guess. Ideally, we'd sweep from that end of the base to the other, destroying certain targets, caulking all but one Tauran. But that was unlikely to happen, as it depended on the Taurans offering very little resistance. On the other hand, if the Taurans showed obvious superiority from the beginning, Cortez would give the order to scatter. Everybody had a different compass bearing for retreat. We'd blossom out in all directions, the survivors to rendezvous in a valley some 40 clicks east of the base. Then we'd see about a return engagement, after the Hope softened the base up a bit.
One last thing, Cortez rasped. Maybe some of you feel the way Potter evidently does. Maybe some of your men feel that way, that we ought to go easy, not make this so much of a bloodbath. Mercy is a luxury, a weakness we can't afford to indulge in at this stage of the war. All we know about the enemy is that they have killed 798 humans. They haven't shown any restraint in attacking our cruisers, and it'd be foolish to expect any this time, this first ground action. They are responsible for the lives of all of your comrades who died in training, and for Ho, and for all the others who are surely going to die today. I can't understand anybody who wants to spare them, but that doesn't make any difference. You have your orders, and what the hell, you might as well know. All of you have a post-hypnotic suggestion that I will trigger by a phrase just before the battle. It will make your job easier. Sergeant, shut up. We're short on time. Get back to your platoons and brief them. We move out in 5 minutes. The platoon leaders returned to their men, leaving Cortez and Tenebus, plus three teddy bears milling around, getting in the way. Chapter 15. We took the last five clicks very carefully, sticking to the highest grass, running across occasional clearings. When we were 500 meters from where the base was supposed to be, Cortez took the third platoon forward to scout, while the rest of us laid low. Cortez's voice came over the general freak. Looks pretty much like we expected. Advance in a file, crawling. When you get to the third platoon, follow your squad leader to the left or right. We did that and wound up with a string of 83 people in a line roughly perpendicular to the direction of attack. We were pretty well hidden, except for the dozen or so teddy bears that mooched along the line, munching grass. There was no sign of life inside the base. All of the buildings were windowless and a uniform shiny white. The huts that were our first objective were large, featureless, half-buried eggs, some 60 meters apart. Cortez assigned one to each grenadier. We were broken into three fire teams. Team A consisted of platoons 2, 4, and 6. Team B was 1, 3, and 5. The command platoon was Team C. Less than a minute now. Filters down. When I say fire, grenadiers, take out your targets. God help you if you miss. There was a sound like a giant's belch, and a stream of five or six iridescent bubbles floated up from the flower-shaped building. They rose with increasing speed until they were almost out of sight, then shot off to the south, over our heads. The ground was suddenly bright, and for the first time in a long time I saw my shadow, a long one, pointed north. The bomb had gone off prematurely. I just had time to think that it didn't make too much difference. It'd still make alphabet soup out of their communications. Drones! A ship came screaming in just about tree level, and a bubble was in the air to meet it. When they contacted, the bubble popped, and the drone exploded into a million tiny fragments. Another one came from the opposite side and suffered the same fate. Fire! Seven bright glares of 500 microton grenades and a sustained concussion that surely would have killed an unprotected man. Filters up! Gray haze of smoke and dust, clouds of dirt falling with a sound like heavy raindrops. Listen up! Scots wa hai we Wallace bled, Scots wham Bruce has often led. Welcome to your gory bed, or to victory.
This ends Disc 2.